Welcome to Enneagram with JB, a podcast about Enneagram personalities, where you'll uncover and discover more about yourself and others through the helpful tool of the Enneagram. I'm your host, Julie Underwood. Hey guys, so today I'm talking to a really good friend of mine, Brandi Wilson. Brandi is a certified personal and executive coach. She recently released her book, Better Than Okay, Finding Hope and Healing After Your Marriage Ends. This book is so good. It did both. It brought me to tears and laughter, all of it all mixed into the same time of reading this book. But she also co-authored a book called Leading and Loving It, Encouragement for Pastors' Wives and Women in Leadership. She works with Leading and Loving It and empowering women in ministry and leadership to develop healthy relationships with themselves so that they can build healthy families, churches, and communities. And that is so needed. She is also passionate about helping women move towards greater mental empowerment and emotional health through workshops, cohorts, speaking engagements, and coaching groups. And Brandi is so, so good at this. So now in her book, Brandi shares the pain, grief, and heartache she endured when her husband and megachurch pastor walked out from her family, and how she has learned how to rise from the pain. Our conversation is going to be filled with aha moments, laughter, probably some tears. So make sure that you share this episode with your friends so that they can hear this conversation too, because it is so heartfelt. So welcome, Brandi.
I'm so happy to be with you, Jackie. Thanks for having me.
Like, we've been friends for a long time.
A long time. And we actually live just a couple miles apart.
We do. However, we are doing this podcast over video, which is hilarious.
Yes.
But we both have coaching practices and full schedules. So
yes, very full schedules. Like, yeah.
Let's just pop on and do this together. Let's have a conversation about real life and what this has looked like. So, but before we jump in, let me ask you a couple personal questions so that our audience can get to know you in a different light, maybe a little bit lighter than some of the stuff that we're going to talk about today.
Let's do it.
What's your favorite Christmas song?
Oh gosh, probably if I'm thinking like beautiful church ones, Oh Holy Night, sung by Natalie Grant.
Oh.
That's probably is the epitome of Christmas for me when we're talking about Christmas music. Now, if I'm talking about my favorite album, Kenny Rogers and Dolly Parton have a Christmas album that I grew up listening to that I still listen to today. That's awesome.
When do you start to decorate for Christmas?
Gosh, I don't have a set schedule. I will tell you what I like. This year, Thanksgiving is really early. So I love when Thanksgiving's early because Christmas stays up longer. So I think I'm going to wait. I have two sons who are in college that will be home for Thanksgiving week. I might do a little bit before they get here, but my goal will be to finish before Thanksgiving while they're here.
Okay. What is your favorite holiday treat?
Oh gosh. I have lots of holiday treats. I make, what do we call it? It's like the Chex Mix and M&Ms and pretzels and white chocolate and puppy chow or something. I don't know. I make that a couple of batches of that every year and all four of us love it. So it never lasts very long. And then my other one would probably just be the pies that everyone makes around the holidays. So even Thanksgiving and Christmas together is when we get pecan pie and chocolate pie. And I love those are very nostalgic desserts for me. From my childhood. So I think that's one of the reasons I love them so much.
Okay. So tell us what Enneagram type you are.
I'm a two with a three wing, and have definitely embraced being a two. I think where I am possibly non-traditional is I don't like the term helper. I prefer, and that's probably why I didn't think I was a two for a long time because, I'm the type of two, and Jackie, you can tell me what this means. I really only help the people I care about. So I'm not the person who helps all these strangers and, you know, people I don't know. I help the people I care about really well. So I kind of prefer when it talks about being a companion, the two being a companion or a partner, supportive partner, something like that fits me way better than helper.
And I think that a lot of twos resonate with that too, Brandi. Like,
there's a lot of twos that are like, yeah, that helper piece just didn't fit. So I just kind of ignored it right away. But what sits below that is like, hey, I really want to know that I'm wanted and loved, like, and needed, you know, in some different environments too, but really kind of digging that, because I think the two and the nine can look a lot alike. And so if you read that helper piece, it's like, no, I'm probably more of a peacemaker or peacekeeper than I am a helper. But then digging through that, I do know at the beginning of the journey with the Enneagram with you, I think you're like, I'm a nine. And then we kind of sat with that and dug through it. And you were one of the people that it took a long time. I have a couple of friends that it's taken a long time to really kind of figure that number out, which if we're talking about the narrative approach to the Enneagram, it does take us a long time because it's self-reflective. And so if we haven't had a ton of space to be able to be self-reflective, then that self-awareness piece is hard, especially, which we're probably going to get into with some of your story. If you're focused on others in a lot of ways, like in your marriage and in ministry and your children, there wasn't a ton of time to even self-reflect. It was like, I need to give you guys what you guys want or need, and then I'm going to figure out how to be okay.
Yeah, for sure. And I think when you're not in a healthy relationship, you function in unhealthy patterns. And I wasn't in a healthy relationship. And one of the most unhealthy patterns that I clung to was just keeping the peace, which aligned with a nine, which when I read and tried to assign myself, I thought I was a nine for a really long time. And it was the process of self-reflection where I remember realizing I'm not a nine. And you know this about me, I was in the middle of doing a ton of personal work and therapy. And I remember like sitting down with my therapist and saying, I don't even know who I am. I'm not a nine. And she was like, and that's okay. Like, it's fine. You're not a nine. But so much had changed in my life that the way I knew myself was not truly who I was, because I was functioning in what was needed for the other person to feel good in that relationship rather than getting what I needed in relationship as well. So yeah, you were super patient. We went through a lot of numbers together. And I remember we had a conversation and a couple weeks out, I think it was with me, you and Steven, and a couple weeks out, you were like, I think I saw some eight come out in you. Let's look at the two. And it took me getting to the point where other parts were recognized for me to even settle in. And it was also coincided with me realizing, those three one-on-one, the subtypes. Once I found my subtype as a two, then I was like, oh my gosh, I think I sent you something on Instagram. I'm like, this is exactly me, which was so affirming to actually feel known in that way.
The Enneagram, when we use it in the proper way, which is a tool for self-awareness and growth, and it is beneficial to read it about other people to grow in empathy and compassion, but not as a tool to use against people, right? But when we're using it for this self-awareness piece, it does feel like, oh my gosh, I'm not broken, or I'm okay. Like, other people feel like this. And so for you and your story, I would imagine a lot of those aha moments made you feel like even maybe a warm hug, where it was like, these things maybe were said in a negative context about me, and this is not true. This is where it comes from. So, but let me back up just before we get into all that stuff. So Brandy and I have been friends for a very long time. Meaning, when I was thinking back to it, I was like 15 years, because the first contact that we had, I think that you commented on a blog I wrote.
I did. Yeah, I did. Jeans. That's exactly right.
And it was this blog. I love jeans, y'all. And
I do too. It's my weakness.
Yes. We have closets full of jeans. And we're like, hey, did you buy these ones? Hey, do you want to try these ones? And I'm always like, you can borrow mine. She's like, I'll buy my own. Thank you. But when it comes to this, I had written this post about, trying to find the right pair of jeans, same size, all these different stores. But when you find the right pair, it just fits. And you had commented on that blog a long time ago. And I'm thankful for my editor and all those nice people that help me spell things right and put punctuation where they should go. Because back then, people just tolerated my writing. But so it started there. And then my husband was approached about a job at the church that you guys, at Cross Point where you guys were. And so we flew, or I think we drove out with our kids.
Yes. And the girls were little.
But all the way back then, so 15 years ago, the twins just turned 15. They got their permit. You're in the thick of it with me, with these girls. But all of these years, and then we took a job at Cross Point and really thought we would grow old together, rocking and rocking chairs, you know, seeing our grandkids play. It just, like, all the things that we thought very much changed in a day. There was a lot leading up to that day, right? But the day that it changed. And so there's so much beauty when I look back, and then there's so much hurt and heartache in the story, and your story, and a lot of other people that were attached to Cross Point during that season. Yeah. What do you, like, when you think back to the 15 years, what do you think about that? Like, that's a long time.
It is a long time. And it's interesting. Longevity of relationship matters to me. So I know we'll probably end up going in this direction at some point, but I will try to cling to something I know really well because I know it, rather than embrace new. So I think one of the things that has been super healing is the way that you and Stephen have stuck with me through it all. And I know we don't have time to dive into all of it, but there was a time there where we didn't speak and we didn't have contact. And I remember reaching out to you for the first time and leaving a voicemail. And my guess is you being hesitant to, like, do I even want to reengage in this? Because it was just so messy and so many layers and so much loss and pain and heartache. And I think, you know, it's just, as you said, it's not anything we foresaw coming, but I'm really grateful that God has given me the ability to be able to re-engage and restore relationship. You know, my marriage was not restored, but my friendships were. And you know that to be true. There are maybe three people I don't talk to from that season of my life. But everyone else I've been able to repair and restore and re-engage with. And that is a gift to me that I might have lost my marriage and I lost the position and the role that I got to fill at the church, but I was able to maintain relationship, and relationship is super vital to who I am and me functioning in my truest self. So I'm really grateful to God for that.
I am too. That was a hard season of quiet. It wasn't even a full year. It was probably, I don't know. It was a little bit of time. But yeah. And yes, the initial recontact was scary. I think it was scary because it was so confusing. I think all the pieces were still starting to get put back on the table. I think you contacted me after, there had been a filing for divorce and things like that. And it was one of those things that you had always said, like, I won't do this. And then you wanted me to know why, like, what happened. Cause you wanted to be truthful to who you were. And, you know, in all of it, yeah, there's so many pieces of it, but I'm thankful for today. I'm thankful how it looks today and the connection that we have and you have with my family and I have with your family today. Okay, I want to talk about this piece around my truth. And you had touched on it a couple minutes ago about like who you are, like trying to figure out my truth. And so in your book, you say, one spring I went through a really horrible joint counseling session with my then husband. There was a lot of tears. She said it was hurtful. I climbed into my well-worn Honda, laid my head on the steering wheel and wept. And then you said, yeah, with those tears came a moment of clarity. I experienced a transparent recognition of my truth, not the hurtful things I'd heard, but whose I was and the character, integrity, and heart he'd created in me. I clearly remember lifting my head and saying out loud, those things are not true. They're not who I am. He doesn't even know me. But in that moment of like, this is not true. If we think about even the 9-2, and you were like, I was a peacekeeper. This is what I was. And then as you were learning, like having some room to breathe around your own story and hearing things about you, that's like, that's not even true about me. Yet that person had a position in my life or even power in my life to tell me what I should think about myself.
Yeah, I think when I think back to that, I almost referenced this a few minutes ago, because I do think that this was my first moment of true self-awareness and reflection. I think a lot of us live with the shame of what we have been told by other people. And it might be an ex-spouse or an ex-boyfriend or girlfriend. It could be a coach from when you were in elementary school, maybe a teacher who told you you never amount to anything. It could be maybe someone you worked for early in your life. Even a parent could have said things that those things bounce around in our heads, and we end up allowing them to be what we believe to be true about ourselves. So for me, I really had to start to become self-aware. And that first journal entry, I remember so clearly exactly where I was, just weeping and thinking, like, he doesn't even know me. Like that. And now I understand what was going on, Jackie. Like, it wasn't about me being known. It was about his narrative being written and all of that. Not what we're talking about. But in that moment, it was this self-reflection of, like, he doesn't even know me. Man, do I even know myself? To have to sit down and start jotting things down. And it was what is true about me at the top, and me writing who I knew myself to be. And I hadn't seen that person in a long time, which brings some sadness. And also, I think, is one of the ways that I was able to battle loneliness, is I might have been alone, but I was getting to know myself again. So in getting to know myself again, I actually enjoyed spending time with myself. But yeah, I think as I continued to grow and become more self-reflective and to do the work, I know you and I have both several times laughed about how life was so much easier before we became self-aware. In that self-awareness, I think for me, as I continued to hear that negative voice, I got to the point a couple of years down the road where I was like, whose voice do I hear in my head? Okay. And I identified that voice, and I knew that's the voice of my ex-husband. And I just became super conscious of, whose voice do I hear in my head? I would identify it. And then I would be like, no, I want the voice of God to be the voice that I hear speaking truth over me. It's God's truth. I want to be the one that guides my life and grows me. So I even put little post-it notes. I have them, a couple still up, that say, whose voice do I hear in my head? Let it be God's. Because as a person of faith, that was super important to me, that I was allowing it to be the word of God in my life.
That's powerful. So as a life coach, this has got to be one of those pieces that you lean into with your clients, probably pretty early on, as far as who are you? Because we can do a lot of work with our clients, but if they, you know, a lot of the work that we do is the unpacking of who are you, and it takes time, you guys. So it's not like the first session with either one of us, you're going to know, this is who I am. It doesn't work like that. But it is this prompting around, who are you and whose voice is that? Let's differentiate the voices. Like, who said this to you? I think back, I did some training at OnSite. We both love OnSite. We are passionate about that. We do not get paid to plug them, but we plug them anyways. We are passionate about OnSite. But during a training there, one of the therapists had talked to us about the importance of the parent-child role. So the parent informs the child of what they should think about themselves. Okay. So really early on, you walk into an environment, and how your parent responds to you kind of indicates how you should think about yourself. So if it's like, hey bud, how was your day? Then it's like, oh, they care about me. And if it's like, shh, I'm on the phone, it's like, oh, maybe they've got other things going on. Not every time, you guys. Okay. Not every single time. Just like, if it's an all the time thing happening, you know what I'm saying? But as we get older, we go into adulthood, the people closest to us become the people that inform us about ourselves. So in a relationship, so married for 20 years here. So we're not talking 3 years into a marriage, Brandy has this awful moment. This is 20 years of building a life with somebody who she attached to. So Brandy and I both are passionate about attachment theory of bonding science. But who she attached to, that she then looked to tell her about herself through the years. So we can see where the differentiating a voice is like, who told me this about myself? And what do I know that's true? I feel like it's like getting a shovel and digging out. But wait a minute.
I think it's super fascinating when I'm working with a client and they say something like, Yeah, I'm not really good at managing business. I'm like, well, who told you you weren't good at managing business? And for they always have to stop and kind of reflect on where did I, or, you know, I've never been good at keeping my life organized. Well, how old were you when someone told you that you weren't good at keeping your life organized? And making them go back and find that, it is that shovel that kind of starts digging us out of being defined by other people.
It is powerful work when you start to recognize it. And, you know, Brandy and I are both in our 40s. So I'll say, like, I don't even like to say it, but here we are. Here we are. And we're more than here we are. It's like we're past the halfway mark. And I'm still like, oh my gosh. But so the other day I had gotten some decals for my car. For the holidays, I'm an Enneagram 7 who I feel like has suppressed a lot of the fun in my life. How should I say this? My Enneagram 3 husband really cares about image. And so, you know, and so he was like, babe, did I see on Amazon that you ordered some decals for your car? And I said, you did. And he was like, are you going to put those on your car? I'm like, for the holidays, I am. I'm going to do it. And he's like, I'm never going to take your car. And I was like, that's fine. That, you know what? My 7 has to come out. Like, I'm going to be. And I did say, like, I don't care about being cool. I just want to be fun. And so I do think, like, some of those pieces, like, who said that I can't put decals on my car? Nobody did. And he doesn't care. And then he came around. He's like, you know, I was just joking with you, right? Like, I love that you did that. I'm like, you're probably still not going to drive my car, but it's even those pieces though. We begin in our relationships, whether it's friendships or romantic partners or, you know, even our work environments, they really begin to shape us into what we think is acceptable and not acceptable. And so we can morph into these pieces, but then when we do the hard work of self-awareness and like, wait a minute, but what do I want to do? Like, you know, for Brandy, like I want a McFlurry. That's what I want right now. So
the problem is because we're in our 40s, I can't have a McFlurry every day, unfortunately. Dang it.
I feel you. It's painful, you guys. Enjoy your younger years and in your bodies in those younger years. These ones, freaking things. I'm like, why does it hurt when I get out of bed? I don't even understand. Okay. So let's talk about self-care. Let's talk about this piece. You've done a ton of work in this area around self-care. You've done therapy, different classes and courses. Like you have really, really dug deep into these different areas. And so self-care, you say it isn't self-indulgent or selfish. It's not one size fits all. Understanding what you need to regenerate and restore is important. And so then you go and list some self-care, which I love. The first two ones of your self-care list, they're just setting boundaries and trusting your gut. So oftentimes when we think about self-care, right, we think about, oh, going to getting a massage or getting a pedicure or whatever this is. But you're talking about something so much deeper than that when we're talking about self-care.
Self-care of the soul. Yeah, I think, and listen, Jackie, I love getting my nails done. I would say a massage is a form of self-care for me. I would say getting my nails done is maintenance. I like it. It's not necessarily relaxing, but it looks good when it's finished. Now, I've had some neck and shoulder issues, so I've gotten a couple massages over the last month. And I do feel like I'm loving myself well to invest in that. But sometimes I feel like getting my roots done is maintenance. Getting my nails done is maintenance. So yeah, I think there are times that we end up counting that as self-care. And then we ignore the parts of ourselves that we really should be caring for, our heart, our soul, our mind. You know, one of the things that I love most about self-care is I discovered I had already done yoga before, you know, life kind of fell apart. But man, when my life fell apart, I dug into yoga and I was there all the time. I had this teacher I adore who's wonderful. And she would do a 75-minute class. And I would realize that 75 minutes was the only time I wasn't thinking about my life falling apart because it kept my mind so occupied, trying to do things I wasn't used to, learning a new form of exercise. It just engaged my body in a different way, and it also engaged my mind in a different way. So I think, I think self-care is more about just the things that make us externally look good. It's about what makes us internally be more of ourselves. And setting boundaries is something that is super important when you're engaging in relationship. Trusting your gut, that is something I totally had to relearn post-divorce, is learning to trust my intuition and my gut, and to lean in and follow that and use that. God created me that way. I'm going to use it as I move forward to make decisions.
Let me lean in there just for a second, because or a couple minutes probably, if I'm being honest. I think that the setting boundaries and trusting your gut, because we're older. I've been married for almost 25 years next month. You were in a marriage for 20 years. These long-term relationships, you learn how to ebb and flow inside of them. And there is a certain measure of like keeping the peace. There is this part. And so when it comes to setting boundaries or trusting your gut, sometimes there is a hesitancy to actually listen to your gut, because it means it's going to stir the pot. Or if you raise a question or you say you're not okay with something, then there's going to be a pushback and there's a fear of rejection or even abandonment that happens inside of relationship. And so the younger me definitely could not figure this out. It was like, if I bring something up, it's going to start a fight. Or if I bring something up and my gut knows and I'm not getting a response, I don't know how to keep going. So then it's kind of like, just forget it and keep moving. But you've gone through this. Like you've gone to the other end of it with rejection and abandonment at the end of this. And looking back at our stories, right? Because we will talk about at the end of this, like looking back, there are things to learn in our stories and in the self-ownership piece of this. When you think back to that setting boundaries or trusting your gut, what do you wish you could have told the younger you about this? Because there's so many things that we wish we could have told the younger us. Trust us, we do. But when it comes to this really heavy topic.
Yeah. And I think, Jackie, you know, we were both married really young. I think I was 22 when I got married. And in a lot of ways, I was growing up with that person. And I had grown up in a pretty traditional family as far as gender roles and in response to things. And I think the thing I would tell my younger self, and I don't even know whether or not I would have been able to grasp what this really meant at 22 or 27, was to not self-abandon. I think that is probably the biggest boundary that I have to grasp onto right now, is that because I'm a two, and because of some family of origin stuff, my immediate response is to often self-abandon in order to make the other person happy, or for the other person to be seen, or for the other person to feel loved, and that I don't stay present with who I am and what I need or want in a situation. I leave myself, and I am still kind of figuring that out. I've gotten better at it. I've gotten more aware of it. I just last week had a moment with my therapist where I was like, oh, this is the first time in my life I have ever recognized internally showing up for myself in a way that was really memorable. Like, I journaled about it because I don't want to forget it. So I think I would tell my younger self, like, don't self-abandon, continue. And I think sometimes as women, we are just given so many messages about how we should show up in marriage and should show up as moms. And, you know, I don't just self-abandon in relationship with a romantic partner. I'll self-abandon with my kids. I'll self-abandon in close friendships. I'm not as likely to as I am a romantic partnership. That's the one that it happens the most in. But I think, I would want my younger self to just be able to recognize the importance of maintaining that relationship with yourself and loving yourself in the process of growing up.
I love that. I love the insight that you're giving. I love the words. Like, I love this piece. Like, even as I'm listening to you talk, I'm like, oh my gosh, yes, I wish that I would have had language around self-abandonment. The Enneagram's numbers 2, 7s, and 9s this grouping, they do tend to self-abandon in a way that looks like, hey, if you guys are okay, I'll figure out how to be okay. Do all Enneagram types self-abandon? Yes, they do. Are there ones that maybe do it a little bit more or fall into the trap a little bit easier? Yes. Twos, sevens, and nines. There is this need for nurture that it's kind of like, okay, what do I need to do to keep the peace, to avoid conflict, to get love, all these things that happen inside of this. And the pause on this is like, what does it look like for you to not self-abandon? And the fear that comes with not self-abandoning is the reality of possible rejection. And so I think understanding why we self-abandon kind of empowers us to recognize it and then begin to make the decision as we mature around, like, for me to self-abandon right now, this is why I'm doing it. Or what would it look like for me to not self-abandon? How can I communicate this in a way that doesn't hurt the relationship, but allows them to know where I'm at with it too? That self-abandonment, I feel like we could just put a pin in it. We're done right here. Everybody go home and do your work. Everybody go journal about that. Like, how y'all doing? Because I am not doing great. I feel very convicted right now. Like, oh. Okay, let's kind of go into this another part of your amazing book that talks about stop trying to resurrect what's dead. So if we're talking about self-awareness and then we're talking about like, hey, how do we not self-abandon? This piece right here is like, stop trying to resurrect what's dead. And there's a quote that you lead with on chapter 14. And it says, are we cooperating with new life waiting to be lived in us? Or are we trying to resurrect the old life because it's all we know? I do so much work around familiar patterns of behavior, as do you, I'm sure, in the coaching space. And so when we start to recognize the familiar patterns are actually not getting us what we want, right? We repeat what we don't repair. So we find ourselves in these like cycles of repetition, hoping for a different result. But in this chapter, you talk about like, stop doing that. Stop trying to resurrect something, like stop it. And share with us a little bit about this part of your story. And what it means for you today.
Yeah, I think you're right. For me, it is about clinging to what I know. And that's where, you know, longevity of relationship is something I know. It also means that when I encounter something familiar, it is going to be something that I would cling to quicker because I recognize the emotion that responds in me. So that's not always a great thing because I have had some unhealthy relationships in my life. And I think there are times when things in our life must end. And instead of us trying to resuscitate that and bring it back to life, we have to be aware of what is going right in our life or what is the new that we need to embrace. And I think I am really guilty of clinging to what is familiar because it is known. And there are times that God is offering me something new and I am clinging to the old rather than stepping into the new, which is going to be healthier and a better fit for who I am today because I'm not the same person I was. And I think often that involves a perspective shift. And, you know, I tell the story about you go to a lot of the Friday night football games with me and my youngest son is QB1. So he plays quarterback. And I realized that I have a really great gift of watching the ball and not him. So we were at a game several weeks ago and he's like on the 40-yard line and we're marching toward our end zone and it's like third down and something. And he throws this bullet to the receiver. The receiver ran a post route, cut into the center of the end zone at the very back. Brewer, my son, throws a bullet. He catches it. I'm watching the ball. So I am like screaming, yelling. I'm always on the top row. I'm usually standing on the top row with cowbell, holding on to, you know, Steven or some person who's close that's stable so I don't fall off the top row. And I'm cheering for like 20 seconds and losing my mind and being obnoxious. And then I turn back to the center of the field and I see the coach and two trainers out there. And I, with a 0 ounce of compassion or concern, I say like, whose kid is down on the field? And my middle son was home that weekend and he turned around and he said, that's Brewer. And that's a different perspective. If I am watching the ball, I see the perspective of the celebration. If I'm watching my kid, I see the hit he took after the ball was released that has left him on the field and able to catch his breath. So I think what we choose to see is often what we follow. So if we're following negative, if we're following what is dead, if that's all we're seeing, then we're missing the good that's actually going on in our lives. So if we want to see good in our lives, we have to look for good in our lives. So I did another early journaling piece for me was, you know, I am a person of faith and I believed that God was still good and nothing in my life felt good. But I just believed at my core, God is still good. And I pulled down a journal and on the front, I wrote focus on the good. And I made myself start listing 3 to 5 things every day that felt good around me. And I was grasping, Jackie, because life really stunk back then. But I just felt like if I could look for the good in my life, I would see the good in my life. And if I'm only looking for the bad, then that's what I'm going to see. And that's what I'm going to cling to. And that's what I'm going to waste all my energy trying to resuscitate. So we don't want to resuscitate what's dead when there's actually good being offered to us. We need to move toward that good.
Share with us just on the practical application side of this, okay? If somebody's listening to this today and is like, okay, I want to go home and I want to implement this, just give us a quick little snippet of that journal entry that you did. Give us just like one day, what did that look like for you?
I remember it would be, gosh, stuff as simple as having, shocker, ice cream on the patio with my kids. I remember one day it said, bought a new hair dryer. And while a hair dryer might not represent good, it did represent new. And I believed that there would be new to come in my life. So writing down a new hair dryer, it wasn't about the hair dryer. It was about there is new coming for you. It is as simple as I saw a sunset that made me, you know, I'm a sucker for sunset. So I see a sunset and I'm like, oh, I just love that moment of recognizing the beauty of nature. It might be taking the dog for a walk. It might be walking around Target by myself without a list, just being able to meander. Kind of clears my mind a little bit. It's nothing that's overcomplicated. It is being able to look for the things that felt good to you that you see as good in your life on a daily basis.
That is such a great practice. Like a gratitude practice, I think, is one of those things. Getting outside in nature is great. Moving your body. Oh my gosh. You said yoga, you know, emotions get trapped in deep tissue. So stretch is really important when you're feeling really overwhelmed and maybe you're in a really, really difficult season. Doing these things that are, they are self-care. They are kind self-care practices that we can give ourselves, and they don't cost anything, you guys. So it's not going to get your nails done or massage or anything like that. These are really practical tips for all of us that we can do. You know, piece of paper, you know, stretching on the floor, whatever that looks like. But I want to talk before we end our conversation today about this, the benefits of our past. And you said we often have a hard time recognizing the benefits of our past because our past contains hurt and disappointment and people who rejected us. And I think all of us probably have some of this in our story to some degree or another. Our past has loss, death, betrayal, unfulfilled dreams, broken relationships, and unmet expectations. There's a long list of things in our past that have the potential to hold us back. But what you have done, and I have witnessed you do, is you have reflected on the past and you have excelled towards the future. You have said, the things that hurt me will not hold me back. And I've watched you. And I mean, I could cry, probably will cry. I watched you do this in step by step, right? And it is like, what is the next best thing? I've heard you say that. Like, what is the next best step? So it's not like 5-year plan. Sometimes it's literally the next foot in front of the other. Talk to us a little bit about how did you do this? How did you pick up all of your pieces and figure out how to find healing on this journey with some reflection, but then the acceleration?
Yeah, I think, you know, I do have 3 sons, and at the time of my divorce, they would have been like 15, 12, and 10. So I had some pretty you know, young kids living with me, watching their mom, witnessing their mom battle depression and anxiety and kind of picking up the pieces of our lives again. And I think pretty quickly I realized that the benefit of my life falling apart meant I got to put the pieces of my life back together the way I wanted. And I think where I was coming from is I was like, great, what do I want? One of the things I had to teach myself was how to dream again. I think that's an area of self-care that we just forget how to dream for ourselves and how to dream for our families. And, you know, every dream that I had up until that point was kind of attached to someone else. And I'm having to dig in and decide like, okay, I want to put the pieces of my life back together the way I choose. What does that look like? And I had to do some dreaming, and I used my notes app on my phone and started like figuring out what I wanted the house that the kids and I were going to move into to look like and feel like and the atmosphere be like. So I think, you know, that was something that was super important for me, was learning to dream again. I think I also just had this processing of he being my ex-husband had taken enough and I wasn't going to give him any more of my life. I'd given 20 years and I was a great wife. I wasn't perfect. We all have faults, but man, I had loved him really well. And I knew that. And I'm like, he got a lot of me. He doesn't get any more. So that allowed me to just clarify my focus of like, I'm not going to spend my time in revenge. I'm not going to spend my time chasing down his lies. I'm not going to spend my time righting his wrongs. I'm going to choose to live my life right now. And that's what I did. And it was legitimately one step at a time, because I do think part of what ends up sidelining us and paralyzing us is that fear of thinking too far ahead. I don't know what 6 months looks like. I don't know what 6 years looks like. I don't know what 16 years looks like. And for me, I realized like, man, I can only do today. So when I was trying to come out of that depression and start again, it became like, what can I do today? What needs to be taken care of today? What conversations do I need to have today? What direction do I need to be facing today? And it became, what is my next best step? And I do think there is such value in long obedience in the right direction. And I just kept trying to take one step after the other in the right direction. To be able to put life back. And I have a great life. Now, Jackie, you know, you've walked really close to me. The last 6 or 7 months have been really tough and things haven't turned out in certain areas the way I thought. And I have found myself kind of in a season of, I would say depression again, and some suffering and some longing for different areas of my life to be changed. And it has also pushed me to the point of healing at a different depth that I might not have had life turned out the way I wanted it to. It has pushed me to heal at a deeper layer. It's pushed me to do some trauma work that I hadn't done yet. It has pushed me to really lean in and think again about what do I want out of my life and not what do I just want my life to look like with another person in it. So, it's that continued self-reflection journey that is at times painful and also worth it when you put the work in.
I always say, like, if you are willing to do the work works. Like, you got to do the work, right?
And I'm going to say something and I think one of the most frustrating things in our lives is when we have someone we care about and we can clearly see what kind of work they need to do, and we can't make them do it because you can never make another person do their work. And that is when that becomes your focus, guess what? You've self-abandoned because you're focusing on what work they need to be doing rather than leaning in to what do I need to be doing right now to take care of myself.
That's good. You guys should write that down. Take a note on that one. I think that the truth of the matter is that you have to feel to heal. And healing takes time. It is a slow, slow process, you guys. A lot of us don't want to do it. We want to medicate it. We don't want to feel it. We want to just distract it, numb it, you know, disassociate ourselves from the healing or from the feeling of the healing. And we want, you know, just take it away, make it go away. It doesn't work like that. True healing takes time. It is long. It is long. And the self-awareness that happens along the way is slow. We will begin to encounter parts of ourselves little by little by little by little as we are able to hold space for our own stories. And the work is yours to do. It's individual work. You cannot make another person do their work. You're right. But you can focus on you. And so I hope today's conversation has helped you focus on or helped you change the focus maybe to even other people and what they need to be doing, and maybe shifted it back towards you and said, like, hey, am I focusing on self-care? Am I functioning in self-abandonment patterns? Am I doing any of these things that are keeping me from what I'm hoping for in my own life? And so you help people do this all the time. You help people find healing and hope in their stories. And you help the single moms on their journey, but you also help a lot of other people in the healing space. So share a little bit about what you're doing today and then how people can find you. How can they connect with you and maybe work with you in this healing journey?
I am pretty easy to find. I am Love Brandi Wilson, Brandi with an I everywhere. My website is lovebrandiwilson.com. My Instagram is lovebrandiwilson, and I can be found on Facebook that way as well. And yeah, I do. I'm like you. I work as a coach, a personal coach, helping people take their best next step. And I do work with a lot of people who are transitioning from married life to divorce, or who've walked through the end of a relationship of some sorts. But I also work with people who are just in transition in life. I think so many people, transitions can sideline us because that's another time where we're figuring out a whole bunch of new in our life. So I work with a lot of people who are going through transition, whether it is learning to set boundaries with their family unit, it is learning to lean in and have healthy communication, if it is recognizing unhealthy patterns of behavior. I do all of that kind of stuff and help them figure out what is their best next step so that they can live that long life of obedience in the right direction.
So if you guys are listening today and you're like, I need to know more about this woman, Brandi Wilson, go find her. Go find her on socials, follow her on social media, connect with her, DM her. She talks back. She likes to talk to people. She's a two.
I do. It might take me a week or so, but I do.
And then lean into that healing space. If you guys are listening to this and you want to learn more about the healing space, you can reach out to Brandi or I, and we can help you get connected in the right area to help you guys take the next best step for your life. So thanks so much, Brandi, for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Jackie. Love you.
And thank you for joining us today. Join us next time as we continue our conversation about the Enneagram and what it means for your relationships. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss a single episode. And while you're there, we'd love for you to leave a review. Your kind words help others find the show. For more great Enneagram content, resources, and individual coaching, you can visit enneagramwithjb.com. And while you're there, make sure to order Jackie's newest book, The Enneagram and Your Marriage. We'll see you next time on Enneagram with JB.